Two women came through first. Debbie identified the first as an aunt of hers who had died of breast cancer. The second was a black woman with a beautiful smile. She was bringing in a tall man wearing creased blue jeans, a blue shirt, and white tennis shoes. "He's telling me he's your dad," he says. This lady was one who greeted him on the other side. "That's Gracie," Debbie said. "She helped raise me. She came to work for my family when I was very young, and she was like a second mother to me. My dad used to drink, and when he got rowdy, we always called Gracie. She was the only one who could calm him down." I thought it was a little odd that Debbie was trying to connect with her dad, and here he was. But the one she was excited about was her maid. She said later she didn't acknowledge her father at first because she wanted more evidence, even though everything I said made sense to her. Her dad never wore a pair of blue jeans that weren't starched with a permanent leg crease. He loved white tennis shoes, and in her hands, as we spoke, was his favorite blue shirt. She was ready to acknowledge Gracie with far less. But Daddy was special. She was holding out for more. She didn't validate anything. But just in case, she had a friend listening in on an extension, taking notes. "This man is acknowledging a marble statue. Does this mean anything to you?" "Yes, it does." "Okay, there's some guy coming through now with dark hair and dark glasses. He's standing beside your dad." "That would be Roy Orbison," she said. "He's saying he's hanging out with this guy that always wore the dark glasses and dark hair. And there's someone else. He's telling me he's with the guy who had the belt that's hanging on the wall." "That would be Elvis." "Elvis? Who is this guy anyway? Who is your dad?" "My dad was Carl Perkins." Well, I was clueless. "I'm sorry," I told her. "I don't know who that is." Debbie responded, "He wrote Blue Suede Shoes. It was Elvis's first big hit." "Holy shit," I said, unable to restrain my shock. I'd gotten Andy Warhol once, but Elvis? "Okay, now he's telling me there's some kind of incident with the dog the night after his funeral. He wants you to know he was there. Do you understand that?" "Yes." Carl's dog's name was Suede Blue, and they were very tight. They had a trick they did together, Carl getting down on his hands and knees and Suede jumping over him. It was a trick Suede would only do with Carl, and after the funeral, Debbie and her mom looked out the window and saw Suede in the backyard, jumping as if Carl were there. Debbie had remarked to her mother that she felt her dad was there. Now he wanted her to know that he was. Debbie was trying to take all of this in when I told her, "Your dad says you don't have to cling so tightly to the shirt you're holding." Now remember, this was a phone reading, and she hadn't validated any of the earlier information, so I did not know she was holding the shirt. I then smelled something. It was musty, dank, like a basement with a moisture problem. Debbie said I seemed to be describing her father's studio. It was next to the pool. "Elvis keeps coming in," I told her. "He and your father had drifted apart in this life, but they are well connected on the other side. Your dad is acknowledging some special picture of him?" "Oh yes, the famous Elvis picture. When Daddy built his recording studio, the first picture he put up was one of Elvis. I asked him if he was ever going to let Elvis die. He told me Elvis would live forever. He wants you to know, Debbie, he knows you did everything to save him. He was so tired, his body was just shutting down. He made the decision to go. He wants you to know that. He realized his work here was done, and he was ready to go. He says he arranged this phone call himself. He's smiling. Something about roses. He still works in the rose bed, but these have no thorns." Debbie said her parents raised beautiful roses, and every morning when they were in bloom, her dad would have a fresh bouquet waiting for her mom when she got up. He always fussed about the thorns. I was blown away by the amount of detail of the information Debbie's dad was giving me. I told her he must have been a very spiritual man, and Debbie said he was. "Did you at some point ask your dad if you were doing the right thing or what you should do?" "I sure did. Those were exactly my last words to him before they closed the casket." "Well, he wants you to know you're doing the right thing, and he will be with you. He's here to help you." "Is there a river behind your house? Did someone pull someone out of it?" "No. But Daddy and I, along with a good friend, Randy Moore, started a song about someone saving a friend from drowning." "That's it," he says to finish it. "It's important." He keeps referring to the word spirit. He says it's important as it relates to you. It would be a year before Debbie realized that this reference had a double meaning. Her father's last business partner introduced her to a music publisher in New York named Mark Fried, who signed her as a songwriter. The name of his company was Spirit Publishing. When I got home, I got a call from Stephen Reed thanking me for doing the reading. Debbie had never had an experience like this, and it really helped her. Her father had died only 3 weeks before. I told Stephen that Debbie's father's energy was amazing for someone so new to the other side. Stephen said that now he could tell me more. The person who had actually asked him to set this up was not Debbie, but a friend of Debbie's father named Rick Korn, who I've mentioned earlier in this audiobook. He was a younger guy about Debbie's age who had met Carl only 3 years before he died, but became extremely close to him. It was Rick who set Debbie up with the Spirit Publishing Company. One day in 1995, Rick's wife, AJ, answered the phone and found an older-sounding man with a major country twang on the other end asking for Rick. "Do we owe one of the gardeners from Tennessee some money?" she asked Rick with a laugh, handing him the phone. But when Rick got on the phone, the man introduced himself as Carl Perkins. When Rick didn't immediately recognize the name, the man said, "I wrote Blue Suede Shoes." The song was literally his calling card. Carl's recording of the song sold more than 1 million copies, for which Sam Phillips, the owner of Sun Records, gave him a pink Cadillac. Carl had a band with his brothers, and they got into a horrible car accident that broke practically every bone in Carl's body. Elvis came to the hospital and told Carl he was going to sing Blue Suede Shoes for him on the Perry Como show. It became a mega hit, but Carl didn't get any money from it and had to actually sue the owner of Sun Records to get the rights back in 1975. Carl's life was like that. He was always trying to overcome the setbacks and obstacles. In 1991, Carl, a heavy smoker, was diagnosed with throat cancer and had to have surgery that the doctors said would probably leave him without a voice. Before the surgery, he offered a deal to God. "Give me my voice, and I will use it to do good." He came out of the surgery singing better than he ever had, with more range, and he kept his end of the bargain. He started the Carl Perkins Center for the Prevention of Child Abuse, which eventually became the second largest center in the country for abused children. After his surgery, Carl began writing more spiritual music, long, poetic songs that he felt came from a different place in the universe from the rock ditties he had written before. He said that while in the hospital, God gave him a tiny glimpse, a feeling, of heaven. And when he got home, Debbie helped him write a song whose lyrics were drawn from the sense of the afterlife that he felt had been given to him by God. The song was called Beyond the Blue, and as he was writing it, Carl realized for the first time that he wasn't afraid to die. Beyond the blue, no one ever dies, no broken hearts, no hungry eyes. Streets paved with gold, frightening winds don't blow. Beyond the blue, we all have a home. No one's left to grow old alone, no fear of the night, no doubt what's right, beyond the blue. When he called Rick Korn that day in 1995, 4 years after his cancer, Carl said he was looking for someone, not necessarily someone in the music business, to help him relaunch his career. He was working on some new music and had some ideas about what he wanted to do with it. A mutual friend had given him Rick's name. They hooked up and began working on projects. They did an album together called Go Cat Go, a line from Blue Suede Shoes, with contributions from Carl's old friends, the three surviving Beatles. Medium Cool, The Pitch. Rami Warren Black was in her car flying through the clouds after her surprise attack reading that night in October of 1998. She got home and told her husband he wouldn't believe what had just happened to her and how she was going to turn that experience into a syndicated television show. So what if Rami's new business partner, Adora English, thought she was absolutely out of her mind for even saying the words psychic medium and TV show in the same sentence? No, not the way to get their business off the ground, not when they've named the company Media Savvy. Well, over the next few months, I put on paper how I saw the concept of the show, with a little help from the boys, my guides. By the spring of 1999, I had regained my footing and felt I was back in their good graces. I knew I was meant to do a show and that it was going to happen. This may sound a lot like my attitude about One Last Time. It was meant to be, so it would be. And we know how that turned out. The difference now was a big one. I knew a show would happen, just not when. Unlike before, I was now at peace with the idea that things would happen in the right place, at the right time, and under the right circumstances. If it happened now, great. If it happened 5 years from now, fine. I was in no hurry. Raimi and Adora liked that. Eventually, Raimi and Adora put together an 8-page proposal, a treatment, they called it, that focused the show on the stories of ordinary people and the loved ones they reconnected with. Raimi wanted to stay close to her initial instinct to build the show around the kind of powerful experience she'd had in the hotel room in October. She put her cover page on her proposal that said, for lack of anything better, The John Edwards Show. Boy, did that look weird on paper. This being TV, Raimi and Adora knew that they would be trying to sell this concept to men and women who would want to know exactly where all this emotion, hope, and closure would be coming from, and how we were going to make sure every episode had it. These were people who lived in a scripted, controlled, neatly packaged world. Raimi and Adora were of this world themselves, so they knew as well as anyone that reality TV, at that time, was an oxymoron. They didn't think that there would be a lot of interest in doing the show if it meant filling an audience with random people and then hoping some of them had interesting dead friends and relatives and that they happened to be the ones who got read. You're leaving this all up to chance? Thanks for coming in. So they came up with a list of ideas to deal with that guaranteed issue before it even came up. Idea: a group of friends come together to hear from their mutual friend who has died of AIDS. He cut them off towards the end of his life. Idea: parents of a young man killed in the TWA Flight 800 crash have come to find a reason why their son had to die. I didn't like the sound of this. Leaving it up to chance was exactly what I've been doing for 15 years, and it seemed to work out fine. Raimi assured me that this was just pitch stuff, things you had to say just to get them to let you in the door. It occurred to me that all those years I'd spent in front of the tube hadn't given me a clue to what was behind it. It's like what they say about how sausage is made. You don't want to know. Raimi gave the whole pitch a catchy tagline. Tune into a miracle with John Edward, the next dimension of talk, and pronounced us ready for daytime. She said she would be sending out a package to half a dozen major syndicators, after which I would have to go out to Los Angeles to meet with the ones that were interested in making a pilot. Syndicators, I asked. Raimi explained that these were companies, or arms of companies, that produce and distribute the scores of daily shows, strips, they're called, that fill up most of the television day. First, Raimi and Adora went around and talked to development executives without me. They wanted to get the, yeah, sure he talks to dead people stuff, right out of the way. Without me there, the programmers could say anything they wanted, and a number of them made the most of that opportunity. This was fine with me. The less time I had to spend in LA, the better. I didn't like the energy of the place, and although I loved Raimi and I adored Adora, I didn't like the vibe. Besides, as a nervous flyer, I could do without a lot of cross-country flights. So Raimi and Adora knew they were not going to get me out there every time some TV executive picked up the phone. Which not all of them did. Or if they did, it was to laugh in Raimi's ear, just as Adora had predicted. A couple of people didn't even want to let us in the door, and there were a couple that let us in, but only for curiosity's sake, Adora told me, but only much later when it didn't matter. At the time, both she and Raimi were all sunshine and optimism. I was the dark cloud. All of this, syndicators, strips, treatments, pilots, was mysterious and complicated to me. It was hard to imagine how you got from here to there. Not a bad time to remember my grandmother's favorite saying, "Don't look at how far you have to go. Look at how far you've already come." Raimi narrowed down the list of people I should meet, and I flew out and started taking meetings. In LA, you don't have meetings or go to meetings, you take them. It must have something to do with the aggressive nature of Hollywood. I'm not sure what you do with meetings after you've taken them. Well, anyway, we took a whole handful. Every time I turned around, I was shaking hands with another vice president of development. There must have been more than 20 meetings over the course of those months. Big groups of TV people around conference tables, all of them grilling me, as I'm sure they never had anyone who had sat at that table before me. And of course, with varying degrees of tact, everyone wanted me to, you know, do it. I couldn't really fault anybody for cross-examining me and for wanting a personal experience before even considering what we were proposing. After all, book publishers wanted to make sure I was real, and how big a risk were they taking? I would hardly be the first medium to publish a book. But I would be the first one to have a syndicated television show if any one of these people decided to pull the trigger on this idea of 30 minutes of daily television, quote-unquote, full of emotion, humor, and enlightenment. I knew Raimi had her work cut out for her, so I told her I would do whatever I could to make her job easier. "If you need me to do strategic readings, I will," I said. All I asked was for a little dignity. I wouldn't read anybody during an introductory meeting or as a prerequisite for a meeting. If they were truly interested in the show, we would arrange something later. And some people seemed to really get what we were talking about. Not that they were running out of their shoes to sign me up. "They're all intrigued and they're all scared," Raimi summed up over the phone after we made the rounds and I was back in New York. "I'm hearing, too risky. Do you have a judge?" TV is an industry that loves a brand new idea as long as someone else has done it first. Dead Man Talking? You go. No, you go. No, you go. I'm sure they wished I was Judge John. I could walk into the soundstage courtroom wearing robes and carrying sage incense, overrule objections that only I could hear, and give my verdict without having to ask the witnesses any questions. Psychic judge. Can't miss. While we were waiting to hear back from the two or three studios that seemed interested, something very fortunate happened. During the summer of 1999, a movie starring Bruce Willis and a remarkable kid named Haley Joel Osment came out, and suddenly everybody in America was saying, "I see dead people." It was as if the sixth sense dropped from the sky, and the people we were talking to looked up and went, "Hmm." I went on Larry King Live with the man who directed and wrote the film. I don't know if his movie made the difference, but it didn't hurt. The first nibble came from Columbia TriStar. Raimi and Adora got all excited when I told them I was seeing a logo with feathers. "Feathers," Adora said. "The Pegasus in the TriStar logo. Okay, it's going to be TriStar." But it wasn't. Maybe I'd gotten my signals crossed. Could the feathers had something to do with the Lucky Duck Productions, which was making the HBO documentary at the same time? Raimi thought the next best shot was Studios USA, producer and distributor of everything from the Sally, Maury, Jerry trio to Law and Order. She'd had some preliminary but promising conversations with people there, and some interesting things started happening, although they are really only interesting in retrospect. While Raimi was starting to woo Studios USA, I got a call at my office from a woman named Tahira Boddy McClure. She worked in the programming department at the Sci-Fi Channel in New York, and one of her jobs was to find new talent and fresh ideas for the network. Tahira told me that her mother-in-law had gone for a private reading after hearing me on WPLJ and had given Tahira one of my brochures. She wanted to talk to me about the possibility of doing a show for Sci-Fi. I thanked Tahira for calling and asked her to get in touch with Raimi. Tahira's call took Raimi by surprise. She thought it was weird that someone from Sci-Fi was trying to get in on the proposal. After all, things were starting to heat up with Studios USA, Sci-Fi's parent company. Anyway, she was glad to send Tahira a demo tape and treatment, so long as Tahira understood that we were setting our sights a little higher than a single cable channel. "Got it," Tahira said. "Of course you're shopping the syndicators, but don't forget about us." Tahira discussed me with her boss, who was interested and wanted to investigate further. When we later pieced the story together, the timing of things suggested maybe a little string pulling from the other side. And I don't mean the West Coast. Here's what happened. A day or so after Raimi and Tahira talked on the phone, Bonnie Hammer, Tahira's boss, was at an event at the William Morris Agency in New York. In the course of mingling with her colleagues, Bonnie heard that Studios USA was going after a deal with a young psychic medium from New York. When a major entertainment company is said to be talking to one of us about a syndicated show, it tends to get talked about, and someone like Bonnie Hammer tends to listen. Whatever happens inside the head of the person who runs a Sci-Fi channel when she recognizes something she wants, that's what seems to have happened to Bonnie. She realized the psychic that Studios USA was pursuing was the same one Tahira had talked to. The first thing next morning, Tahira went to Bonnie's office with the tape she'd just gotten from Raimi. They watched it together, and 10 minutes later, Tahira was on the phone setting up a meeting. In the meantime, Bonnie and Tahira came out and sat in on a small group reading at the Holiday Inn on Long Island that was practically my home stage. During the reading, there were messages for Bonnie from members of her family that she validated and appreciated. I liked her right away. There was definitely something special about her. She seemed to really get what I was all about, without even knowing much about me. Bonnie said later, "Nothing was popping until I saw this piece of tape." She told me at that first meeting that she wanted to take the next step and get approval from her boss in LA to make a pilot. "I would really love to do something with you," she said. "I would love to just let you do what you do and just capture it with cameras." Despite all the good feelings with Sci-Fi, Raimi saw it as a backup. She was going hard for the channel's big sister. There was a woman at Studios USA named Libby Gill who was as gung-ho as Bonnie. But Raimi thought she had them hooked. 2 weeks later, I was getting off a plane in Tucson for the Miraval experiment with Gary Schwartz when I got a cell-to-cell call from Raimi. "They want the show," she screamed. "Studios USA, they want the show." Silence on my end. "It's not going to happen," I said. "What do you mean it's not going to happen?" "I don't know. Something's not right. I'm not getting it. I'm getting that it's not going to happen." "John, they just called. They want the show. They want to make a deal." "No, it's not going to happen."
"I can't believe you're saying that," Raimi said, crestfallen. "I mean, we already popped the champagne."
"Sorry, better put the cork back in the bottle." That was on a Friday. On Monday, Raimi called back. "Well, about that champagne, it looks like we have to do one more meeting. There was someone new moving into a top job at Studios USA, and we would need her support. We had the meeting in New York, and Adora came out thinking we'd sail through." "She's going to pass," I said. Adora hoped this was a case of a psychic having an off day. "You read your people, we'll read ours." A few days later, the new programming chief at Studios USA turned our green light red. "She thinks it's too risky for her first project," Raimi said, "so we're back to square one." Raimi's call confirmed what I already knew, but it stirred up that old eternal dialogue with the boys again. Once again, I had to wonder what the deal was. Universally speaking, I mean. Why put me through all these meetings and hard work with these big syndication companies if you're only going to blow me out of the water in the end? Unlike 9 months before, though, I wasn't about to slip into a funk over this. I allowed myself one bad day, checked back in with my TV show mantra, "Yeah, fine, whatever, if it happens now, it happens now," and just said, "Screw it, not my time." My boys had a plan. All I had to do was trust them and watch it happen. This time, it was easy to turn the corner and focus on other things. Namely, ironically, one last time. The book was out in paperback, A Second Chance at Life, and this time, I was taking some control of the process. Starting in 1999, I went on a 40-city tour that would last 9 months and help put the book on some regional bestseller lists, although nationally it would remain only a moderate success. But with my new and improved zen-like attitude and knowing that at least this time I was doing it my way, I didn't spend a lot of time worrying about numbers. Having exhausted our possibilities with all the big TV syndication companies, square one for Raimi Nador was the Sci-Fi Channel. Raimi called Bonnie Hammer, who was ready to pounce. All she had to do was get the support of her boss, Stephen Chow, president of USA Cable. Stephen had popped in for 5 minutes at my first meeting with Bonnie earlier that summer. He joked around, "Hey, what am I thinking?" which is his style, and talked about the potential for syndicating the show even if it started on Sci-Fi. I didn't know if he was a believer or not, but as Bonnie says, that wasn't the point. His only concern was that he didn't want to have an imposter, which is very different from does he believe or not believe, Bonnie said. If I had any concerns about doing the show for a channel with the word fiction in its name, Stephen moved quickly to diffuse that. "That's the name of the channel," he had said at the meeting, "and the truth is that to a lot of people, this is science fiction, but there are a lot of people who believe it, and they're going to be watching this channel." I had to believe Stephen knew something about breaking new ground in TV, so his support soothed the letdown Raimi felt about not making a deal with the big syndicator. It sounded like we might eventually get there anyway. The catch. Here's how it works in television. If the programmers at a network like an idea for a show on paper, they order a pilot to see if it translates onto the screen. Bonnie Hammer wanted a pilot in a hurry, 6 weeks, so we got right down to planning. One good thing about doing the show for Sci-Fi was that we were in New York. We had a long list of things that had to be discussed and decided. The format of the show was the big issue, and within that were a million smaller ones. How much of the show would be readings? Who would be read? How many people would be in the audience? How would they be chosen? Would there be celebrity readings? What about a co-host? And then there was an equal number of technical TV questions. And of course, what was the show going to be called? Everyone seemed to want my name in the title, but maybe as the second part, as in something or other with John Edward. One of the names on the list of candidates was Crossing Over. And the consensus seemed to be, yeah, okay, that's fine for now. We've got more pressing problems. This was just a pilot. We'd come up with a title eventually. It dawned on Bonnie that it was a blessing that we were starting at Sci-Fi. This was Crossing Over in more ways than one. Nothing like this had ever been attempted in television, so syndicating it from scratch might have been the worst thing we could do. Instead, we can give the show what Raimi called a soft launch, a quiet, measured beginning on cable, like opening a Broadway show on the road to get the kinks out.
Plus, as Stephen Chow had pointed out, we would be on a channel whose viewers would be predisposed to believing what they were seeing. We could build an audience from there. We could let the show evolve, make our mistakes, figure out what worked and what didn't. And then, if things went well and Stephen and his boss, the legendary Barry Diller, liked what they saw, we'd have a shot at a wider audience through syndication. Raimi hired a director named Peter Kimball, who had worked on Oprah, and he arranged to borrow and redress the Maury Povich set, a Studios USA show that was shot at the Hotel Pennsylvania across the street from Madison Square Garden. The first big decision Bonnie made was that I would be on my own. She didn't like the idea of a co-host, not after she came to the group reading on Long Island. "I want pure John," she said. Uh-oh. I really didn't think pure John was such a great idea. "I've never done this before," I protested. "I've never had to talk to a camera." Well, that wasn't completely true. I remember being on a show in Boston once where they asked me to read something from a teleprompter. I was bad. Really, really bad. But Bonnie is an awfully persuasive person, especially when she believes in something. Raimi and Adora said, "Don't worry, you'll be fine. If you really can't do it, we'll have to revisit and find another way of doing it, maybe with voiceovers." In the back of my mind, I was thinking that this was just a pilot. Bonnie will let me have a co-host if and when we do get the real show, because she's going to see how bad I am. For now, my attitude about the whole thing was that all I knew about television was how to work the remote. Bonnie, Raimi, and Adora were the TV people, and it would be up to them to figure out how to turn this idea we had been talking about for a year into something that Stephen Chow could pop into his VCR in LA and see what he needed to see to call up Bonnie in New York and say, "Let's do it." As long as they didn't interfere with my work, I wouldn't interfere with theirs. Interference turned out to be a matter of, let's just say, interpretation. We taped the pilot on a Friday and Saturday in early December, and during one session on stage, I read a family for whom a spirit came through very forcefully. "It's like, boom, boom, and he falls," I told them. Then I was shown the face of a friend of mine and Sandra's, a flight attendant for TWA. "Did he pass in a crash?" I asked. "It's Flight 800, isn't it?" And it was. Then a while later, I was pulled over to a woman in the audience. "You went to Mexico?" I said. "Yes." "There was a night when people got really smashed. Someone ended up face down in the sand?" "Yes." "Your sister wants you to know that she saw the whole thing." Wait a minute. Did she die in a plane crash too?" There were several more families that had lost relatives in the explosion of the New York to Paris TWA Flight 800 off the South Shore of Long Island in 1996. Knowing that our opportunities to gather strong material for the pilot would be limited, Raimi thought bringing in families of the TWA victims was a prudent idea. But I was uncomfortable with it, mostly because it represented a violation of one of my most basic guiding principles. These people no doubt came in expecting, or at least hoping, that I would connect with the person they lost in the accident. If I was preaching the gospel of check your expectations at the door, it would be hypocritical of me to be actually raising those expectations myself. Raimi had mentioned during the planning stages that she might try to come up with some themes for the pilot. I wasn't wild about the idea, but I wanted to let her do her thing and didn't think too much about it. But now that I had experienced it, I felt more than ever that this had to be a show that essentially produced itself. It couldn't be like a regular talk show where most of the work happened before an inch of tape was shot. Producers racking their brains for fresh ideas, hitting the phones to book the right guests, researching the topic to prep the star, and then scripting, editing, and packaging the show to exploit that fresh idea to the max. That could not be the process in Crossing Over, or whatever we were calling this. In this show, ideas would be what we got after we taped. Booking only needed to mean opening the doors to the studio and getting everybody in a seat. The real guests would announce themselves, in their way, at their time, and we couldn't in any way think of the people who came to the show as vehicles brought in for our use. So Raimi had to abandon all the other ideas that were apparently being discussed. Families of victims of the Oklahoma City bombing, people with organ transplant who wanted to connect with their donors, and, yes, Saturday Night Dead, bringing in the families and friends of Gilda Radner, Phil Hartman, and other departed Saturday Night Live stars. On those 2 days in December, we shot hours and hours of tape, trying different approaches to see what worked best. Raimi brought in an audience of about 100, and others much smaller. They tried some different lighting and camera positions, some different ways of introducing and closing the show. I just did what they told me, wore the clothes they handed me, spoke the words they wrote for me, and then did what I do. I was determined to ignore all the TV stuff and concentrate on not changing anything about the work. Bonnie just wanted to capture it with cameras. I just had to make sure I wasn't captured by the cameras. After 2 days of shooting, Raimi had the pilot edited and packaged. The name of the show? Crossing Over with John Edward. Nobody ever got around to revisiting the title, and it just sort of stuck. I liked the pilot. It was compelling, but restrained, not overdone. But Bonnie thought it needed to be faster, more polished, to get it past her bosses in California. You do a pilot for one reason, Remy explained to me. That's to get a green light. Once we get that, then you can move the show forward the way you want. But this is all about getting approval. So we were really only making this pilot for the one or two people who had the power to say yes or no. We have to think of their sensibilities, Remy said. Remy brought a box of videotapes home to L.A. and delivered them to Gene Wigman, an experienced producer and editor who recut the pilot with an editing room full of young, fast video editors. The content of the new version wasn't a lot different from the first one, but the opening was glitzier and the segues between segments were New York fast. A lot of rapid-fire cuts of the best moments from the upcoming segment with hip sci-fi music and glib one-liners. You can argue with the living, but the dead get the final word, laid over it. There was a celebrity reading with actress Carrie War, the star of Sliders, a sci-fi show about a parallel universe. My own parallel universe was now in the hands of the Lords of L.A. Although Raimi had delivered the pilot quickly, there was no immediate reply from the network. I wasn't privy, of course, to the discussions between Bonnie and the people above her, and I don't mean parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles, but I've since learned they had to do with making sure there really was a television show here, with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Closure. We were looking for some of that ourselves. USA Networks made it official a few weeks later, announcing that Crossing Over would begin production in May and be on the air by summer. It would be on nightly at 11 o'clock, Sunday through Thursday, on the Sci-Fi Channel, for 13 weeks at least. Raimi and Adore would have loved to be able to be there when the show began to crawl and then take its first wobbly steps, but they had been tied down by the daily grind of syndicated television for 20 years. It wouldn't make sense for them to jump right back in, no matter how exciting and innovative the show was, and no matter how emotionally invested in it they were. They would remain attached to the show as executive consultants, but their final job, and they knew it was a crucial one, would be to make sure they put in place a production team they trusted, people they knew I would be comfortable with. Raimi and Adora had no fears at all about Bonnie Hammer. They told me I couldn't be in better hands. But Bonnie wouldn't be the only one I would be dealing with at the corporate level, and she wouldn't be producing the show. She agreed with Media Savvy that it was vital to make sure the key people were not even remotely cynical about the material. This couldn't be just another gig to them. A few months earlier, when Raimi was looking for someone to direct the pilot, she had checked with Richard Lawrence, her agent, and he had recommended a New York-based director named Dana Calderwood. Raimi met Dana, and both of them clicked right away. Dana was very open to the subject matter. He was so eager to do the pilot that he tried to wiggle out of a commitment he'd made to go to Florida the same week to direct Double Dare 2000 for Nickelodeon. He couldn't get out of it, and Raimi found somebody else. But now that the show was a go, she hoped he was available for more than a couple of days' work. Dana was a great director with a solid list of credits and an Emmy nomination. He was also one of the few directors based in New York. Most important, he got the show. She urged Bonnie to call him. Bonnie did call Dana along with a few other directors and producers. Among them was Shirley Abraham, an experienced producer with a no-nonsense yet maternal style and a talent for assembling a solid staff. What Bonnie didn't know was that Dana and Shirley were partners. They and a third associate, Charles Nordlander, a writer-producer, had a company called Glow in the Dark Productions. Bonnie was talking to other people, but she liked the glow-in-the-dark threesome and wanted to see what kind of chemistry we might have. The first thing that was clear was that all three were intrigued and excited by the prospect of working on something so out of the mold. Having spent years in the trenches of the conventional, they thought this could be groundbreaking television, not a phrase they used lightly. I refer to people who have no experience with spiritual subjects as being green. The glow-in-the-dark producers were not that. All of them had at least some degree of belief and experience with the idea of the survival of the soul and after-death communication. What they needed to do was translate that to the television. They needed to know who I was as a person and what I wanted to accomplish as a medium. What was the message of the show? Not a question often asked in television. And by the way, that question and a thousand others had to be answered very quickly. Sci-Fi wanted the show up and running in less than 3 months. I had never thought about what goes on into the making of a TV show, but it wasn't exactly point and shoot. Not only would the producers have to hire more producers and the crew, but they would have to create a format and get it approved, find a studio, and design and build a set. And they would have to turn me into a television personality. You know how I was pretty much assuming they'd give me my co-host so I could just come out and do readings? not happening. Bonnie still wanted pure John. Bonnie was adamant. Obnoxiously insistent is how she later put it. You don't need a crutch. So that was that. My only crutches would be the people producing the show. I liked the guys from Glow in the Dark, and so did Bonnie. And so did Raimi and Adora. So Dana Caldwood, Shirley Abraham, and Charles Nordlander became the first three members of the production team of Crossing Over with John Edward and no co-host. Right after that, the new producers went on a recruiting binge. The first person Dana called was a producer he had worked with at a show called Fox After Breakfast. The guy's name was Paul Shavelson, and Dana said he was incredibly smart and creative and funny. His name sounded familiar, but I couldn't quite place it. Dana said Fox After Breakfast didn't last very long, but it was preceded by a cable version called Breakfast Time, a wild, free-form show that had gotten major buzz and positive press during the 4 years Paul had produced it. Dana said Paul would be the perfect person to help conceive Crossing Over, if we can get him. Dana called Paul and asked him if he was interested in working on a show about a guy who talks to dead people, a guy named John Edward. That's weird, Paul told him. I was riding the train with a friend of mine a few weeks ago, and he told me about this guy. He saw a documentary on HBO and was telling me all about him. Although he was interested in the subject, he had to deal with a built-in bias against people who made a career on being psychic. I thought really spiritual people internalized it, Paul has since told me. They didn't really preach, and they definitely didn't make money on it. It's almost like a professional psychic is an oxymoron. You're psychic, so you don't need money. Paul wasn't so lofty on the subject that he didn't want Dana to send him the pilot. But when he watched it, he was skeptical that Crossing Over could be a credible television show. I'm fascinated by John, and I would love to meet him and see what's in his head, he told Dana. But I don't see this as a TV show. It doesn't look real to me. It almost looked like magic. Who's going to believe it? We all know that magic is an illusion, and you can assume that on television, you can do anything you want. If you give me enough money, I can make my house float. I could levitate anything. So as fascinating as the subject is to me, I don't know if this will ever be a vehicle for TV. Dana must have thought Paul was giving him a big, resounding no thanks. But what he was really saying was that there was only one way to make this idea work, and that was to find a way for viewers to take something from the experience of watching other people's departed relatives come through. As Paul later put it, how can we grow from that experience of knowing that their souls are still a part of our lives? How can we connect? Paul said he'd like to at least see if this could be done. Dana was hoping that Paul would say that. What he thought this project needed was a lot of careful thought by a group of smart people with integrity and a sure grasp of the subject. And fast. A lot of decisions had to be made quickly. There's something here, Dana said. Well, the only way to really see what it is to work with him live, Paul said. There was no time to waste. He would have to come and see me at my next event a few days later. But it would involve a little traveling. Paul and Dana would have to come to Barbados. Crossing Over. In May of 2000, three of my favorite mediums, Shelley Peck, Suzanne Northrup, and Robert Brown from England, joined me for a retreat. I gathered 50 people from all over the country and a few from as far as Australia for a shorts and bare feet event on Barbados. It turned out to be one of the most magical experiences I've ever had. We did a series of psychic workshops during the day led by Sandy Anastasi, one of my first mentors, and her husband, John Myers. And then at night, we divided the participants into four groups. Red, blue, green, and orange, for readings by the four mediums. We rotated each night so each group of about 12 would be read by each medium during the week. My hope and goal was that by the end of the retreat, every person would get a message from at least one relative. If I couldn't get something, maybe Suzanne would. And if Suzanne couldn't, maybe Shelley would. And if Shelley couldn't, well, maybe Robert would. Some phenomenal things happened that week, the first being that my colleagues agreed to join me. It was a lot of work for them, a major commitment of time. For the participants, meanwhile, it was a wonderful, emotionally satisfying bonding experience, both with their loved ones who had passed and with each other. On the first night, each group was united by color, but by the fourth, they were like a family. They could recognize each other's relatives when they came through. No, that's your uncle. Remember, he came through with Shelley the other night. The energy of these people was fantastic, and the setting was perfect. On the last night of the retreat, we had what I called a healing circle. Everyone came together and talked about their experiences during the week and what they had learned from them, We laughed and cried, a very therapeutic finale to an affecting week. And then I did something I had not intended to do. Before going to Barbados, I had thought about bringing a certain song by Celine Dion to play at the end of the retreat, but I had decided that it would be too emotional, for me anyway. The song is one that I associated with a friend of mine who had died 8 months earlier. Clyde Corday was 62 when he died, and he had been with his partner Patrick for 30 years. Clyde was truly a compassionate person, funny, with an amazing energy. You couldn't help but love him. Until he got sick, he was very youthful looking, and he reminded me of the actor Nathan Lane. This is pretty much all you need to know about Clyde. At the height of my gloom in 1999, after I flew home from an event that didn't go well with my tail between my legs, I walked into my home to find Clyde and Patrick with a dinner they had prepared for Sandra and me, complete with soothing music and candlelight. When I walked in, Clyde said, "I know you're feeling like what you're doing is not being received well, but I needed to come and do this for you and tell you that you are loved and you're doing the right thing and you're helping a lot of people." A few months later, I was just home from another trip when I heard that Clyde had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. I went straight to the hospital. I hadn't seen him in a while, and he looked so old. He opened his eyes and he looked at me. "Hey, Clyde," I said, still standing near the door. "Who are you?" he asked, and my heart dropped. "Clyde, it's John." "John? John Edward?" "Yeah, John Edward." "Shit. What's the matter, Clyde? Did I cross over?" "No, Clyde." "Oh, good. I just figured you'd be about the only person I'd still be able to talk to in case I did." Well, we laughed about it, and I walked over and I took his hand, and I asked him how he was doing. He looked at me and shook his head. "I think I'm leaving, John," he said. Driving home from the hospital, I put in Celine Dion's new CD, All the Way. Near the end, there was a track called Live, a song about a beautiful starry night, not a night to die, and the feeling of wanting to live for the one you love, and loving as no one has ever loved before. I drove home in tears, listening to these words after saying goodbye to my dying friend just destroyed me. Live your life as best as you can and love like you've never loved before. Clyde died soon after that. "I want to end tonight in a special way," I announced as the healing circle and the retreat drew to a close. "I want to prepare you because I think it's going to be extremely emotional. But I can't think of any better way for me to end what we've all accomplished here this week." I dimmed the lights, and we all sat in a circle, everyone feeling a connection to the people who were strangers to them 6 days earlier. They understood the bonds that they had lost through death, and the rejoining they felt that week was magical. I started the circle by asking each person to make an acknowledgement of those who had crossed over, and I could feel the emotion rise in the room. When it was my turn, I said, "This is in honor of my friend Clyde." I stopped and tried to get the words out. "I know he's watching, and the rest of our family and friends, who we all have spoken to this week, are here watching us." I started the song, and as it echoed loudly off the walls, everyone in the room started to break down, one by one. When it was over, I knew I would make retreats both in the United States and abroad part of my life in the coming years. But I knew that this first experience was so perfect that it would be forever special to all of us, both on this side and on the other. The Talent. Two last-minute guests had dropped in on my retreat midway through the week. Dana Calderwood came down with Paul Shavelson, the producer he and his partners in Glow in the Dark Productions were trying to bring onto Crossing Over. Bonnie Hammer wanted us to be shooting our first shows in 6 weeks, basically a barn raising, and Dana was hoping that 48 Hours in Paradise would present Paul with the evidence he needed to bring him into the fold. Meanwhile, Dana brought a portable digital video camera with him to shoot some of the readings for the show. Dana and his partner Shirley Abraham were well into creating the show by this time. They found the studio, had a set designed, and were in the process of forming the backbone of the show staff, recruiting the producers who would do the day-to-day work of turning out segments that honestly reflected 15-minute readings in less than 5 minutes of tape. This wasn't your regular TV show, so for Shirley and Dana, hiring these producers wasn't as simple as collecting resumes or calling people they had worked with before. The people who worked on Crossing Over had to be considered not only for their TV work, but also for their cosmic attitudes. They didn't have to be in the 20% who are true believers, but they couldn't be in the 20% on the other end of the scale either. My usual standard held. Skeptics are fine. Cynics need not apply. Of course, Paul was coming to Barbados with a suitcase of skepticism that had nothing to do with a belief in a conscious afterlife. He was down for that. What he wasn't convinced of was the viability of a TV show about the subject hosted by a psychic medium. But it was just that conflict that put him on the plane. He believed in the topic. He was interested in me, and he wanted to see if there was any way to make this marriage work. Paul watched me read a group the night he arrived, and he was struck by how straightforward the readings were. It's like you're just a guy giving some directions, make a left, make a right, just matter-of-factly mapping it out, he told me. This is no mumbo-jumbo. I didn't have much time to talk to Paul and Dana during the retreat. Paul didn't care. He wanted to see me in action, and just as important, he wanted to see how the readings affected people. To him, they represented the core audience of Crossing Over. He pulled many of them aside, and with Dana rolling the digital camera, talked to them about their readings, trying to understand what was going on between us, and whether he could discern from that the essence of the show. What difference did it mean to you that John knew your father's name? Why is that important? Paul would ask someone. It wasn't so much that he knew his name, he would be told. It's the fact that he knew that we used to go shopping at John's bargain stores and that he loved Clam's Casino. It means there's this presence. I'm not cut off from him like cold turkey. He's still a part of my life and my growth, my journey. Paul heard story after story like this, as if this was a big focus group. And by the end of the first night, he knew he would do the show. He says he came into the skeptical, but you could have fooled me. At our first meetings back in New York, he talked intensely about building the show around the kinds of people he and Dana had met at the retreat. He liked the way I did my work and delivered information, but he thought it was their stories and what viewers might take from them that would make the show fly. The readings are the vehicle, and they have to be shown in as genuine a light as possible, but it all has to be with an eye toward connecting the viewers with the spirits in their own lives, Paul said. To show you just making psychic statements that these people react to isn't enough. I'm more interested in the subject of continued consciousness and how to use a psychic medium's talents to deal with grief and make your experience here in this lifetime richer. Thinking about the unique connection the show might have with its viewers and how the people in the studio could be seen as their surrogates, it occurred to Paul that calling them an audience didn't do justice to their role. He had an idea. Let's call it the gallery, he suggested. Each person you read will be a portrait in the gallery. Everyone loved the idea. Paul was on a roll. One night after a meeting, I offered him a ride home to Long Island, and we wound up sitting on the FDR Drive for 2 hours, waiting for a car fire to be cleared. It was the first quality time I'd had with Paul, and we spent it, naturally, talking about the show. It was the beginning of what became regular commutes to and from the city, during which we got to know each other's backgrounds and motivations, and discovered we shared the same irreverent sense of humor. I began to feel that Paul's energy was like manna from heaven. Paul was right. He was perfect for the show. It wasn't just that his vision was the same as mine. It was that he helped clarify what my vision was and how we could get it to the screen. In television, anyone who gets in front of a camera is known as the talent. Paul got right away that while it was an unusual talent that got me here, I wasn't going to be confused with an entertainer. I wasn't doing this for the money, and I sure wasn't doing it for the fame. As corny as it sounds, I was doing it to reach people, so many more than I could by what I was doing already. Of course, I wanted a lot of people to watch the show, but what concerned me most were the lives that the show would touch. At an early meeting, I introduced everyone to my favorite phrase, honor the process. I expected it to be the guiding principle of the show. No matter what pressures they felt from the network or from within themselves, no matter what the numbers or the ratings were, they had to resist whatever TV instincts they had to do anything hokey or exploitive. You really don't care about TV, Paul said in the car one day, as if I were a member of some species he'd never encountered before. That's why this is going to work. With Paul's arrival, Raimi and Adora felt ready to cut the cord. It was like an open adoption, Adora said, where we all kind of just sat in a circle and said, okay, this baby is yours now. Call us. Keep in touch. Let us know what we can do. Camera One closes in. What is this? In the morning of June 14, 2000, I stood in the darkness outside the white sails cloaking the set of the first television show devoted to communication with the dead. My eyes were trained on Doug Fogel, the stage manager. He had been stage manager for The Lion King on Broadway, among many other things, and a couple of months earlier he had gotten a call from his old friend Dana Calderwood asking if he wanted to work on a TV show with a psychic. Why not, Doug said. It's a job. 3, 2, 1. Doug pointed to me, and I bounded out for the first time before a live gallery and cameras rolling tape, knowing that some of what was about to happen would find its way onto TV screens across the country. Crossing Over with John Edward was launched, and my life would never be the same. Even if the show were a colossal flop, more people would see me in a single night than in a lifetime of lectures. I managed to get through the opening and welcome the first official gallery, and by extension, the first few 100,000 viewers, or whatever number would be tuned into Sci-Fi, or stopping by on their way to a tearjerker on Lifetime or Spinning Wheels on the Game Show Channel. I rubbed my hands together, focused on the sale beyond the last row, and silently delivered the welcome to the other gallery, the one that really counted. The first few weeks, I felt like a little kid bicycling with training wheels and still falling every time I turned. But as Raimi pointed out, we were starting out in relative obscurity. Compared to the syndication she had been shooting for, we were practically doing this in private. So if there was a time to tumble, get back on the bike, and find my balance, this would be it. I wasn't the only one trying to find my way. There was a whole staff of people trying to find my way for me, and theirs. We were all struggling to figure out how to do a show that was so different from anything ever attempted on television that most of the 56 people hired to produce it weren't even sure what it was. If I was so psychic that I could read everybody's mind, here's what I would have heard those first few weeks. Is this for real? That's what a lot of them were asking each other in private conversations. Jim Skurdy, a camera operator for 31 years, pulled Dana aside and asked for the truth. Is this on the level or is this a gimmick? Dana basically told him that all he had to do was look through his camera lens. Eventually, he'd see the truth for himself. A few people on the staff wondered if they were participating in a hoax so sophisticated that no one working on the show knew about it. One crew member took producer Allison Blecker aside and asked bluntly, "Allison, is this bullshit?" She said she didn't think so, but she really didn't know, at least not yet. With half the first season already shot, we finally got on the air in July, and that was like turning on a switch. The mail started coming in. People wanted tickets to the gallery or to get one-on-one readings, and the show began to gather energy and take on a certain rhythm. A little before 9 o'clock, three mornings a week, the day's gallery would line up outside the studio doors on 9th Avenue. Then Jesse Schaefer, our friendly gallery coordinator, would bring our guests inside, get them seated, and tell them what the show was all about. I would take the stage at around 10 and welcome my first guest from the other side. This system yielded plenty of good readings, and not all of them were for the people in the gallery. In case anyone was under the impression that spirits knew and cared that we were making a TV show here, a show whose credibility we wanted to establish quickly and firmly, they wasted no time setting everyone straight. We had 100 people in the gallery, but we also had half that number working on and around the set and in the control room. The inevitable happened almost immediately. One day, an older male figure came through claiming he had developed some kind of technical device. "I have a cousin who worked on a water purifier," a man in the gallery said. "No," I said, "this is some kind of healthcare procedure. Invasive surgical practice or procedure." I looked around the gallery. No takers. Then a voice from beyond. "My godfather worked on the first heart transplant." I looked up and saw that it was Doug, the stage manager. I just laughed and shook my head and said, "Nobody's safe." "Has he passed?" I asked. Doug said yes. "Godfather's here." Just then, another spirit stepped forward. I felt that Doug's godfather was there as an escort. "But I feel like he needs to announce what he's known for." "That would be my godfather," Doug said wryly. "By the way, he almost didn't get credit for that transplant thing. I feel like he was passed up." "The credit went to someone else," Doug acknowledged. When he was posted later, Doug explained that his godfather was a cardiovascular thoracic surgeon as well as a mechanical engineer. When the first heart transplants were being performed in the 1960s, his godfather developed a machine that kept patients alive during the few minutes when they had no heart. Doug said his godfather was very egocentric and didn't feel that he got the credit he deserved. The person Doug's godfather was bringing with him had an even stronger energy. This was a younger male who was acknowledging either a Marge or Maggie and had wanted to thank Doug for taking care of his art. As Doug later explained, the person coming through was a friend named Michael, an artist who died of AIDS. Maggie was Michael's close friend. Like his wife, but not his wife, Doug said, who had nursed him as he was dying. Doug and his partner had loved a reproduction Michael made of a painting by Donald Roller Wilson, an artist known for his oil paintings of chimps in dresses. The one they liked was a picture of a chimp named Naughty Betty, dressed like a woman with a huge floral headdress and pickles flying through the air. Doug commissioned Michael to reproduce another of Wilson's paintings, but then Michael got sick and never finished it. After he passed, Maggie gave Doug and his partner Michael's original Naughty Betty reproduction. They had it framed and put it up in a featured spot in their front room. There were several other major validations, thanks to Michael being as demonstrative in spirit as he was in the body. He showed me a cat being held by its tail so I would talk about how everyone despised his cat. And he got me to flip my wrist in a swatting motion, a mannerism that Doug said was a perfect rendition of Michael's don't even gesture. After we wrapped that day, Doug went home and called Maggie and told her, Michael came to visit me at work today. It was like this throughout the first 2 months of the show's life. One staff member after another doing their jobs on the set or in the control room and slowly realizing that the names and details coming from my mouth were not for anyone in the gallery. Some of the more veteran crew members came into this job thinking that they had seen and done it all. The work had long since lost its glamour. Jim Skurdy, a camera operator for 31 years and a multiple Emmy winner, had heard that this was a talk show with a medium. Fine, whatever, it's a job. But I'll never forget the sight of Jim peeking out from behind his camera viewfinder and saying, I knew a guy in high school named Gaspari who committed suicide. One. Another example of a reading for someone not in the gallery happened one day when I was badgering a poor group of women who were sitting in the back row diagonally to my left. I couldn't understand how they didn't know that they had a male suicide who passed in a car accident who was making references to someone named Richard, another named Tony or maybe Timmy, and that there was a connection to a teacher, to a falls